Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Bilge Pumps, episode 27. This one is being introduced by myself, Drac, or Drakinifel, and we have with us today Dr. Alexander Clark, the regular one-third of our cast. Jamie is probably asleep because it's very late in Australia, because they're on the other side of the world, and so all their time is wrong. And we have with us a special guest today, James, who is not Jamie.
No,
he is still a James, but he's a member of the Royal Navy, and we are going to be talking about missiles.
Which is always fun, but we will also point out that this does add further proof to our argument that the world is round. So for those people who occasionally comment on bilge pumps, who seem to be flat earthers, or at least trying to do it to wind us up, it's round. Okay, it's round. It's proved it by the fact Jamie's asleep while we're awake.
Or at least two-sided.
Yes, at least two-sided.
Could be like the Discworld.
That could be quite interesting.
You never know.
Anyway,
could be actually a cuboid.
Mm. Oh, don't go on about time cube.
Yes, sorry about that.
Yeah. That's a good internet meme. Missiles, specifically the anti-shipping variety.
Okay, so what I know I can share is all open source. So if anyone wants to go critique it, be my guest. So I'm not...
Don't worry, I already have the names of at least three people who I know will be critiquing by their handles on Discord, because we have some excellent listeners, and you can already tell which ones will jump in on each one.
That's fine. I'm just giving you the open source. I'm not telling you the real stuff.
That's good.
I guess I'll start off with this one. So we've got, at least as far from my perspective goes, and this is probably the first point of discussion, there seem to be three main strands of anti-shipping missiles these days in development. You've got the extremely fast, I guess, Russian origin, although China and India seem to be taking up the idea now, with a lot of derivatives. The very fast, relatively large missiles that rely on penetrating defences simply by arriving so quickly that there's only so many missiles you can fire at them. So it becomes an equation of X number of missiles arriving over Y number of seconds. How many missiles can we actually fire? They need plus one and they'll get through, not accounting for CRWS. You've then got what I'd term...
Yes, but Drac, do you and I count CIWS? Because let's be honest, you and I spend a lot of time talking about how it's very, very small caliber and pointless.
They might get lucky once in a blue moon, but you never know.
In a blue moon? Okay, I think it would be a black moon or an orange moon, maybe even a turquoise moon. I think a blue moon's...
But then you've got the... I guess what you might call legacy systems. So things like Harpoon and Exocet, where although their sensors and their motors and et cetera have been upgraded, they are fundamentally subsonic sea skimming missiles of varying descriptions. And then you've got, as far as I can tell, a slightly new wave coming in of much smaller weapons, mostly aircraft mounted, which again are subsonic, but because unlike Harpoon, which is still fairly chunky, you might get a couple on a usual strike aircraft. These smaller ones, you can fit half a dozen or more, at which point it's not so much you can't shoot any individual one down. It's more we're going to fire so many of them at you that you don't have enough anti-aircraft missiles to take them all down. And yes, an individual impact probably isn't going to total the ship, but it will mess you up to a point that we can just come back with anything down to just guided bombs and blow you up, because there's virtually nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. So, take your point. So there's about four different types. So you have the hypersonics, the supersonics, subsonic, and then the one you mentioned, the smaller caliber ones. It's also split into different, like, types, so it's down to what seeker's got as well. So the majority you tend to find is a active seeker head, which is the one that basically turns on at a certain distance, finds your ship, and just flies straight at it. You have other things that go for your IR. So infrared, basically finds the hottest point of the ship, go for that. You have TV guided, so it's like a TV guided bomb, but that's a bit of a closer range type thing. You occasionally have a dual sensor one, which utilizes active and passive. The anti-radiation missile is an up-and-coming missile. It's been used, obviously, before, since about 1950-odd. That goes for your radars. And there's a couple of other little variations, but I'm not going to tell you about that one. Hypersonic, we'll touch on first. So I guess most of you probably already know about SSN-33 Zircon. So in a sense, Zircon is a Mark 8 missile. But instead of using a ballistic trajectory like most hypersonic missiles, it's more of a wave top level missile. So it obviously uses Mark 8 to go at the ship. It also has this quote unquote plasma field, which is designed to confuse the radar into thinking that it's a rain squall or something. Although, that being said, if you've got a radar and it's actually seeing a Mark 8 rain squall coming at you, probably going to realize what that is. And then you've got the variations of the BrahMos 2, which is what India is developing. That's a variation of Zircon. And then America's also trying to design their own hypersonic missile. I'm not too sure how well that's going. Don't really hear much of it, but I know they are developing the system to try and counter what Russia's got. Now, it's interesting because what Russia's trying to do is they're fitting it to the, I think it's the Gorshkov class. I keep on getting the Grigorievich and Gorshkov mixed up. It's the more sleeker version instead of the knockoff Talwar type thing. But that's, as of the last couple of days, has launched its first Zircon launch off the North Cape, which is quite interesting to actually see if that thing is actually going to work or not. It's still in development. However, I believe within the next year and a half, it will be operational, if not already is. When it comes to your supersonics, you have a vast array of things. So you go from the Mark 1 to Mark 5. It's a crazy amount of missiles in that range. Stuff like the Russian ones, which is Sunburn, Shipwreck, Sandbox, Switchblade. That's subsonic. Too many missiles being invested that Russia actually operates. Now, Switchblade is the Russian version of Harpoon. Sizzler. So you have stuff like that. And then when it comes to more of a like European NATO side, you have the Gabriel system, which is just bordering on the supersonic era type thing, not supersonic speeds. And then you have the two variations of what actually you go for. So Russia goes for the big, massive missiles, and then NATO goes for the smaller missiles. So we'll touch on Russia. So Russia's idea was to launch these big, massive missiles to go up against the carrier strike group, because obviously Russia doesn't actually have the capabilities to launch, to have so many carriers. So they went for something different. So they operated they built the Oscars, the Kirovs, the Slava / Moskva, whichever classification you want to class the cruisers as, and they're operating Sandbox, Switchblade, is the new one, Saccade, which is the Chinese variation, and Sunburn is the bigger one. Those are designed to fly in fast, do as much damage as possible. It's like a larger caliber gun shell from World War II. It's the same principle, using a lot of weight and a lot of explosive just to annihilate your target. So that's what the Russians kind of do. When it comes to British and NATO and all those countries, they use about 4 Harpoons, Exocets, that type of thing, as more of a disabling weapon system. So it uses less of a punch, but more of them. Because we go under the idea of, you know, if we pacify the target, it's not going to come back for a very long time. It's the same if we use a 5.56 round when we're firing from an assault rifle. If you shoot someone with 2 of those, they'll go down. It'll take two more people with it because you need the medics to, you know, help them. It's that type of thing. Looking at the subsonics, you've obviously got Harpoon, Exocet, Naval Strike Missile, which is the new one that Norway, those countries up there, kind of operate, as well as China has a few, Iran's using a few, Charlie 802, Charlie 801, Sardine, which is Charlie 801, that type of thing. It's sort of funky, weird names all beginning with S. And they're just, they're kind of your smaller weapons. They will just, they'll screw you over, don't get me wrong. You don't want to be hit by one, but they're more easier to be taken out with your point defense missile system, like Aster, SM2, SM3, Sea Scepter, per se. Plus even on shorter range. And then you've got your air-launched ones. So looking at the Martler system on the Wildcat, that's kind of the smaller end. It's good against a bigger target. You can destroy some weapon systems. You can probably knock out the main gun turret or radars, which is probably a good idea, or even the bridge. It gets a bit funky when you actually look at some of the things that Russia's got. So AS-17, which is the air-launched Krypton variant. Air-launched Krypton. It's a Sunburn / Switch. It's a Sunburn variant. And it has an ARM version and a active version. And trust me, you don't want to be hit by one of those. That's a shit breaker, per se.
They use that from their backfires, don't they? That's what fired them.
Yeah, they also be fired by flankers, frogfoots, that type of thing. China also uses a variation of it as its primary strike missile from its large badgers. So, kind of what they use.
Although the fact that we still call those badgers always worries me, because the Chinese have gone for about four different evolutions of building them, and the new ones are, yes, they still look like the original badger, I have to admit that, but you have to be, if they've gone for the thing of making four variants, the odds are the engines, the avionics, and various other things have been upgraded.
Yeah, that's true. It's like the same with the Bear. Like the TU-95 is now the TU-142.
Yeah.
It's the point of where, do you still call it that? It's like building a ship and then refitting over so many times. Is it the same ship afterwards? Same with Victory.
Yeah. Oh, we won't get it. HMS Victory is always an interesting one on that one. But she went through several major rebuilds, but, you know, she won all those battles.
This
was in the point when we know Chatham Docks and at the various dockyards, when their version of a major rebuild was, the ship was stripped down and they built a completely new ship, because they could get money from the government for rebuilding a ship. They couldn't get money for building a new ship.
It's always the way, isn't it?
Yes. It also explains why a ship can suddenly tell you, they're suddenly going, yes, but at this point in its career, it could suddenly mount a weight of armament, which was about three times the weight of it had been amount when it first launched. Yes, and that can you can only put that weight onto the ship because those timbers will still take it, or did they have to rebuild the whole ship and put in new timbers? Probably. I won't jump into this too much, because we do have an engineer on here who actually could tell us the odds are. Drac, do you think they were originally built to be able to take that weight of firepower, or did they have to be rebuilt?
To be honest, given who built them in the first place, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if they were so hideously overbuilt they just had to connect a few beams together to stop a little bit of flex and warping.
Potentially, of course, that is the other option.
From my understanding, when it comes to rebuilding ships to take heavier firepower, a lot of the time it only ever really works on ships that were massively overbuilt in the first place, because if you're effectively having to build in an entire new support structure into a ship that was just barely to with its original loadout, it's going to cost an awful lot of money. B, it's going to add a massive amount of weight to the ship. And C, obviously, all you're doing is distributing that force elsewhere. And if the rest of your ship was built equally to just about acceptable spec, then all you're doing really is making further problems for yourself, because you're going to end up here with cracks and splits in places you really didn't anticipate, like amidships when all your heavy weight is in the front or vice versa. Whereas if a ship's got a fairly chunky safety factor built in the first place, then chances are it probably can actually handle the upgrade anyway, but it would shorten the hull life of the ship quite considerably. So at that point, by adding in relatively fewer and therefore less intrusive and less heavy reinforcement elements, or possibly altering the tubes or whatever, you can end up with a ship that you might have knocked a year or two off of its hull life, but in the grand scheme of things, it's still going to have the bulk of its service life ahead of it, and it can take the weight.
Hmm.
Yeah. And it's, well, it's one of the things when I came across, I can't remember what file it was. You might have come across this as well in Admiralty archives in Q. There was some speculation in the late 1930s about when the Lion class were coming in.
Mm-hmm.
There was some speculation about unifying the armament and switching out the Nelson's old 16-inch guns for the same 16-inch 45s that were being newly developed for the Lions, because they knew the lightweight shell wasn't quite as good as they'd hoped, and it would have made the logistics situation a lot simpler. But when they looked into it, they realized that, as you know, with the Nelson's 16-inch triples being downrated versions of the G3's triples, they'd had enough problems making sure they didn't bend and warp and jam all the time. And they just spent 15 years fixing it, and now adding an entirely new gun with entirely new characteristics and weight and recoil would have just set them all back to square one. So it wasn't possible. And as it turned out, they never actually quite finished getting the new 16-inch 45 ready anyway, so it didn't happen. But it wasn't a possibility flat out. Whereas, again, theoretically on paper, the new 15-inch guns that they designed, well, they'd begun to design for the King George V's back in the early 30s. Theoretically, there's nothing engineering-wise to say they couldn't have refitted Hood and the Renowns and the QEs with those new 15-inch guns, because when you look at the safety factors and the inherent strength built into the 15-inch 42 mountings, there was enough inherent strength there to do it with relatively minor structural modifications. Obviously, if they changed the shell quite significantly, they would have needed new shell hoists. But it was possible from an engineering standpoint, whereas for the Nelsons, it really wasn't. But with that was an even more paper exercise. I think I've only ever seen that margin, like scribbled in the marginal notes of a sketch on the early King KGVs, because, of course, they didn't actually go through with the 15-inch armament on the KGVs at all.
Which was really silly. But actually, just for any listeners who aren't quite sure why this is all relevant to a discussion about modern missiles, the most famous missile-carrying barges in the world are, of course, the Peter Velicky and his sisters. And they are going through massive rebuilds, and that's how you sort of get... And I'm fairly certain at least one of those is going to turn out with an insane number of Zircons. I'm not sure how many the Russians will cram onto one, but basically take your pick and just work out that. And just remember that they will be wanting to have more missiles aboard than Sejong the Great does, because they can't have the South Koreans beating them in the race to see which ship has the most missiles on. Not when your ship is nuclear powered.
Yeah, and when the Sejong the Greats are less than half the displacement.
Yeah. But there was at one point, Sejong the Greats did actually at one point have more missiles than the
Although with the mild qualifier that some of the Russian missiles are about the size of a small bus.
Yes.
Mm.
Which is another reason why I do wonder about using the 20mm to try and stop them, because I don't think a 20mm cannon can stop a bus in time within rain at that speed.
Mm. So
a MAC-3 bus is going to be quite difficult to stop before it hits me.
So when it comes to SeaWiz, especially with, say, for instance, Phalanx or Goalkeeper, it's when they fire, it's like, I don't know if you ever watched a minigun when it fires and it's just that, pretty much. It's like a shotgun. You ain't going to stop that, because it's still going Mach 3, Mach 2. Mm. And once you've hit it at that magical, I guess, 0.8 nautical miles away from the ship is the OS range for Phalanx, that's still going to hit your ship. And nowadays, ships aren't actually armoured. So it's still going to have splinter damage. It's still going to do a lot of damage to you. Don't forget, most weapons...
all the radars and other sensors exposed.
True.
All the fuel that's on board is now on fire.
Exactly. The thing is, though, most missiles are way of top level. So once those splinters go off and tear through your ship, you're going to start flooding anyway. And there's no point trying to, you know, sort of say, IA will take it, I don't know, in the rear end, or take it on a ramp, or take it on the flight deck. It's not Mach 1, it's not even going to get that high. And two, it's just... they're stupid.
Mm.
They're a design of, oh, we can do this, just to keep people happy. But in reality, then they're going to do nothing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's going all the way back to battleships, in the classic era of the battleship, the idea wasn't so much, we have armor, we can take loads of hits, and then we'll kill the enemy. The idea was, ideally, we just want to hit the enemy and keep hitting them until they stop moving. And if they happen to get a lucky hit in, we have like 20% of our total displacement devoted to armor to make sure that doesn't kill us. But we'd really rather they didn't.
And basically, the other idea is that it should be able to take a hit once. The enemy won't hit the same spot again. That's the point. I mean, the whole idea wasn't that we can keep being hit in the same spot and we find. No, it was made, we're going to keep moving, and if we're hit in that one spot, that's going to cause it to be annoying. It's going to shake the ship up, but it'll be fine as long as they don't hit that same spot again or anywhere too close to it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like even when you look at the final engagement between Bismarck, Rodney, and King George V, on paper, Rodney's armor at the distances it was initially engaging would be able to tank a hit from Bismarck's 15-inch guns. Rodney's captain wasn't a moron, so he was dodging and weaving the ship all over the place to make sure he didn't get hit by any of Bismarck's shells.
Mm.
Because, yeah, just because you on paper can, doesn't mean you should.
Yeah,
especially as you say, when you're talking about fragments and bits of rocket motor and a possible part detonating 500-pound high-explosive warhead smacking into you somewhere near the waterline, you do not... It's like, in a lot of ways, that's actually a lot worse, because the average... statistically, the average battleship shell hits somewhere higher in the ship. And yes, having half your superstructure blown away is annoying and probably not too good for the men who are inside it, but it doesn't massively affect the ability of your ship to stay afloat. And if it's not taken out your fire control system, it doesn't affect your ability to fight all that much either until the hits start adding up. Whereas, yeah, if you've just got effectively a shotgun of splinters to the bow, you're taking on water and you are going to need to slow down very quickly unless you want that bow down to be permanent.
Yeah, exactly. But even with like the smaller ships, you know, if you take, say, for instance, a section of a Krypton into the side, it's you're getting bad. What's the best word for it?
Mission killed?
Yeah, pretty much. Take 445. If you hit the flipping midships underneath either the forward or aft funnel, yeah, that's sayonara. She's a goner. Same with the 42s. You know, X set, even if it's small, it still does a lot of damage. Just look at the Sheffield. That was a single hit. That was two deck. That was above the waterline. And even she, that was just a mission kill completely. That was a ship killer. Granted, nowadays they've designed ships to be less damaged by an anti-ship missile, but don't forget that, you know, if you're going to have something hitting you at subsonic speed, maybe supersonic, maybe even hypersonic, it's still going to do a lot of damage. So why you look at, say, for instance, the 23, it's designed with three superstructures. Obviously, a forward, funnel, and then the hangar. That's designed to stop the flames from, and damage, from just knocking out the entire superstructure. Which is probably good to see in the fact that it's got a torpedo magazine in the after superstructure. That goes up. Bye-bye to Type 23. But it's an interesting world of we can defend against it.
Mm.
But if it hits us, you might as well just abandon ship there and then if you see the missiles coming inbound. You see the missiles inbound.
Which you might not at that high speed.
Yeah, sometimes atmospheric does not help you on that that one. Mm. And it could pop up around about 2 nautical miles away and then you're like, ah, oh, damn.
Yeah. This is why we like airborne early warning.
Yes.
I suppose it also factors into, at that point, just the sheer size of the ship, because we've been on previous episodes when we've been discussing what should the future of some of the future surface combatants that people are designing. And one of the advantages of building, because we've discussed with the sort of semi-autonomous stuff coming along that maybe the US should invest for its next large surface combatant and sort of something in the region of 15 to 20,000 tons, maybe a bit bigger, with a bunch of much, much smaller autonomous platforms guarding it. And one of the relatively understated aspects of that is that if you have a ship that's 15, 20, 25,000 tons or whatever, it's physically going to be of a size such that it can, obviously you never want it to, but if it absolutely has to, it may be able to actually absorb a hit or two, because a given amount of explosive is going to do proportionally less damage to a ship that's twice the volume as compared to mass manufacturing dozens and dozens of 4 or 5,000 tonners, which may well just be blown in half at that point. It doesn't actually matter where it hits. Which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was one of the weaknesses of the Type 42s, in that they were actually relatively small hulls. Compared to 45.
One of the weaknesses, I won't jump in too much, but as I think I said, my dad was a naval architect many times, and you can look him up, and he did decide to, one of the classes he was called in to fix was the Type 42, and he had various comments to make about the people who'd save money on steel thickness on those ships. And none of them were particularly nice. In that, just because it theoretically works on paper doesn't mean you should do it. And because it saves a little bit of money certainly doesn't mean you should do it. And they were very lucky they were never caught in a room alone with him. I think they would have had a long, long lecture.
Yeah, they were rather small. Like, in terms of contemporaries, they are larger than a World War II era destroyer. They were kind of verging on the size of a light cruiser. However, in size, they technically were by World War II. But yeah.
They're closer to sort of the Arethusa class, maybe. They're really baby light cruisers. Possibly. I think they're probably too light to be a Dido, even. I'm mentally going through the things. Definitely nowhere near a Leander or a Town class.
Oh God, definitely not. No.
I think that kind of bears it out, doesn't it? Because you look at the damage that some of the larger cruisers in World War II, like some of the Counties and Belfast, for example, the kind of damage they took and survived, as opposed to some of the smaller ships. I'm thinking of maybe something like, actually, I was doing some research on this for a 5-minute guide. Charybdis, one of the Didos, takes a couple of torpedoes amidships. Now, okay, fair enough. 2 torpedoes amidships on the machinery spaces probably would put down a town, maybe a county, depending on location anyway. But for Charybdis, it was over and on the sea bottom within 30 minutes. Just because it didn't have the volume to withstand the flooding.
Although, conversely, HMS Eskimo loses her bow torpedo and still survives. But there again, she was a tribal-class destroyer.
The advantage of losing your bow like that is that, yes, a large section of your ship is flooded. However, that section of your ship that is flooded is no longer part of the rest of your ship. So technically, you have actually lost weight.
Yeah, yes, so you can float higher in the water and go, look at my new slimline figure.
Which I'm guessing probably modern ships probably aren't going to take as kindly to losing their bows.
Well, look at the ex-Berkeley, the one in the Greek service. That's they're plastic fantastic. You know, they will survive, but no, she is on the small side. She's a right half and a half. But just going back to 42s, when it comes to, you know, the survivability, granted, taking two, maybe three bomb hits or an exocet is a bad idea and it'll sink. Newcastle did run herself aground on a rock and did take a lot of flooding, and she still just survived. But that's probably down to the crew, actually.
Sure. I suppose it's where the damage is as well, isn't it? If you run aground, that's where the flooding is. You can contain it. If you take a missile hit, it's like, well, there's probably flooding where the missile hit, but there's also all these other holes and fires and things all around it, which are going to make it much more difficult to get to and seal off that section.
It's anything internally for ships. Obviously, you have hatches. 9 times out of 10, they will stop, say, for instance, flooding. You know, flooding, the pressure behind it will keep the door shut. When it comes to an explosion, depending how close to the bulkhead it is, it can actually blow the door open or puncture the actual bulkhead. So anti-ship missiles are probably the best, funny enough, way of sinking a ship, but it's also kind of the worst to try and stop. Because no matter how much stuff you can throw into the air, so surface-to-air missiles, point defense missiles, or sewers, unless you're rocking around with a Kashtan or Panzer system, you're not going to stop it. But if you try to armor against it, it's not going to work, because you're going to have a ship that's absolutely massive, and even if it hits, say, for instance, on the belt, you're still going to have all that spalling damage on the inside, and that's going to kill a lot of people. It's going to probably break a load of stuff. Modern ships are very, very light. They're designed to take a missile straight through the one side and out the other side. 9 times out of 10, that will work. Sometimes it won't work. Sometimes it'll blow them too.
And I suppose the thing is also in the 1950s, in the early generations of anti-shipping missiles, where they were having to factor in that a lot of their targets may well have belt armor and other armor protection of some description. They proved back then that you can build an anti-shipping missile that can kill an armored ship. It just has to be carrying a slightly bigger warhead. And if they can do it in the 50s, they can certainly do it today. So it's the early 20th century, it's this race between guns and armor. But once you go from, say, a high thousands, low to mid 2000s pounds AP shell that maybe only has a 20-40 kilo explosive warhead, and suddenly you switch to a missile that weighs four times that but carries a sort of a shaped charge that's in and of itself probably weighs almost as much as some of the older armor piercing shells. That level of lethality jump is so great that you'd need to be building something that would make Yamato look like a lifeboat to have sufficient protection against it, at which point it would then be relatively trivial to just double the size of the missile, because going from a 5-ton to a 10-ton missile is a lot smaller of a step than going from 150 to a 300,000-ton warship.
You and I would quite like the 300,000-ton warship, let's be honest, Drac. You and I can have a lot of fun with a 300,000-ton warship.
I mean, the idea of taking a couple of Yamatos and then strapping them to the side of an even bigger hull and turning it into some kind of abominable trimaran is hilarious. But I'd hate to see the look on the shipyard's face who had to actually deal with that order.
But just think of the fun, and think of the US Navy's face.
Yeah, it's just like, well, here you go, Newport News. Here's an order. It's like, is this for a ship? Well, kind of. Well, it's really, really big. Yeah, this is 1/3 of the ship. You then have to build another one, and then you'll have to build two more sections and join them together in the water. Then you have to weld it all together. And I think we've reinvented the mobile offshore base.
Mobile offshore.
Probably at that point, be large enough to get its own MP and postcode.
To be honest, it's not the craziest thing I've ever designed, so...
Having its own MP and postcode could be quite useful again. That would finally get the Navy back confirmed boat votes. Navy used to have seats in Parliament which it could basically decide who was going to get.
But in terms of, obviously, this is sort of the survivability end, but obviously we've got kind of our legacy missile designs we mentioned at the outset. And I guess the long range supersonics and hypersonics, they're designed under a paradigm of, we don't suspect that our launch platforms will last all that long trying to get into the surface to air missile umbrella. Therefore, we will launch from beyond the range, and if the defenses just have to deal with the missiles, and well, if we fail, we can always go back and reload. At least we're still alive. Whereas this newer approach with the much smaller, very, very much smaller missiles, they seem to be more based around the paradigm of, we're presumably through stealth, we actually can get close enough for these much smaller weapons to be launched, even though we're technically inside of the defense envelope of the enemy fleet or individual ship.
Mm.
What are your thoughts on that in terms of how likely do you think that is to actually work? I mean, I do kind of like the idea of someone looking up into the night sky and saying, why is that constellation moving? And it's actually about 200 martlets. But
So it all depends on how good your resolution on your radars are. Like, when it comes to physics, obviously, say you guys know what a radar does, sine waves and all that jazz. But when it comes to actually trying to work out what is coming out to you, you only have, say, for instance, IFF will probably tell you what you are. But also, if there's a contact there, it will display as a radar paint, which will be the absorbent, well, the radar basically hitting it, coming back. It's how you kind of detect what's contact. Sometimes you'll get a contact, sometimes you will just see this squiggly little line of there's something there. 9 times out of 10, ships these days are designed to, obviously, you know, reflect the radar. Sometimes they have an RCS the size of a tugboat. Mm-hmm. But I personally not really seen the stealth type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I know the lads, when they did Westland 18, the Zumwalt, one of the Zumwalts, I think it was the Michael Mawson, they detected that thing on radar about 18 nautical miles. That was off the east coast of America. But that's because of the weird shape. If you get ships that's like that, it would be a good thing because you can get in close, launch everything you need to, and then run away, hopefully. Unless you design something that's like an Abdeel class mine layer and 40 knots straight in, blow it up, go away. But that's kind of why they use the patrol, well, missile gunboats, like the Osas and Talwars, no, Osas are Trantals and stuff like that. But it's a good idea, but it comes with a lot of vague, like, there's a lot of risk to it. Because you don't want to send up an aircraft knowing that it ain't coming back, because that's a loss of capability. And definitely for NATO, you don't want to lose the capabilities because you ain't going to have it. Mm-hmm. Whereas Russia just pretty much doesn't really give a crap about their aircraft. They'll literally fly helixes left, right, and center, and if they come back, oh, well, never mind. It's kind of one of those things.
Send in the next wave.
Pretty much, yeah.
And just gets even more fun when you're dealing with the Chinese.
Oh, yes, definitely. It's like when the Kuznetsov last went to sea into the past Strait of Gibraltar. She lost a frogfoot off the coast of Jib. And they didn't really care. They just carried on steaming. Didn't even launch a helo. So if they say, ah, well, never mind. It's one of those things. And then I'm not even going to get into flipping Kuznetsov and his stupid vertical launch sandbox and it being a heavy aviation cruiser.
Wasn't that mostly a kind of a design to technically allow them to pass through the Dardanelles?
It is, yes.
They kind of ran away with it.
Yeah, so the idea came from, funny enough, the Kiev.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, launches the absolutely awful Yak-38, but even still, it could take out a carrier battle group, or most of the carrier battle group, with its ASHMs. But then they kind of run away with, obviously, oh, we'll have a full deck aircraft carrier with a VLS. Just why not?
Yeah, the placing of that was interesting. But
yeah.
How do I put this politely? With some of these things, you sit there and go, they are so freaking obvious. It's absurd. It's like the Japanese not aircraft carrier destroyers.
Is it on Hugo?
Let's be honest. Although, to be fair, the British did start it. We had through deck cruisers first. Before anyone else, we had through deck cruisers.
Yeah, but at least we were only trying to deceive our own politicians. Well, once they were in service, they were just like, yeah, this is okay.
We sit there and go, what has it got to the point that the Royal Navy has to do that to get stuff into service? It has to deceive its politicians. But also, I sit there and go, if I was the politicians, I'd be really worried about the Type 32s right now.
Yeah.
Because they're the Type 32s. I have a feeling listening to the latest out thing and what a minister has said, I think the Royal Navy's conned them into building what we've been talking about the US Navy getting. Because they're calling them a autonomous shipping mothership.
Yeah.
I think the Royal Navy's getting the ship and then they're going to announce another class of vessels, which are going to be the unmanned ships.
That's an interesting
thing, isn't it? It's like, what exactly is that all going to turn into? But
see what hull they use.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I will make a £5 bet on that one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fairly sure it's going to be the Type 31 hull.
Just so you know, viewers, we are not endorsing gambling here.
No. We're not endorsing gambling or anything. It's just if you consider which hull are the British government allowed to build in any yard they want to in the country. Can they build the Type 2? They can only build the Type 26 in yards owned by BAE. However, Type 31, they can move to, or a Type 31 hull, they can build in other yards. Mm. They're talking about wanting to spread the building load. So, listeners, guess which world class they're probably going to go for. Because also, if they design a new hull from scratch, that will probably mean BAE will have to be involved in it somewhere. In which case, again, those same yards come up as potential build sites. So the government has kind of backed themselves into a corner where there's only one option.
Mm.
But it's a competition. We all know that.
Yes. A competition that if you go for one of them, you get absolutely shafted.
Mm-hmm.
And another one, actually, you might get a decent ship.
Yeah.
And I won't mention who's who.
To be honest, it could go for either way for both designs.
True.
But it could go either way. But, you know.
Yeah. Looking at the track record of some ships.
I happen to know the officers in charge of both projects in the Royal Navy and both Type 26s and Type 31s. And I will say this. One of those officers goes to work every day with a smile on his face and very happily and whistles. And I have never known anyone say such nice things about the company he's working with. And the other one, I think, probably has to get kicked out of bed in the morning by his significant other. And probably is basically told he has to go whether he wants to or not. I won't say which is which, but I'm sure my colleagues here can guess which is which.
I wonder.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I suppose that brings around to another question, which is we've got updated but very legacy systems on some ships. Some of the Type 45s have now got their Harpoon launchers.
Mm.
And the French are still wandering around with some latest version of Exocet.
Mm-hmm.
do we think that as and when someone finally decides we are going to have to replace these, whether it be a Harpoon, Exocet or whatever, do we think we're going to be seeing a shift towards the high-end, high-speed, larger missiles or the lower-end, low-speed but more numerous ones? Because to be perfectly honest, I personally can't see much of a future for the relatively visible mid-sized subsonic missile.
Hmm. Okay, so personally, if I was the procurement in the Royal Navy and I was designing the ships, I would probably go for a 45 with SSN 14 launches, but not the SSN 14. Yeah. Might actually make the ship look a little bit better than, oh, we're all for defense. Yay. So, personally, looking at what's going on, I would say we're going to ditch the harpoons because, not gonna lie, Harpoon, you could probably overtake here with a speedboat with a good gust of wind from the rear.
I think a fairy swordfish might clock them.
That's very true. Yeah. Maybe even a skewer.
Oh, that's cruel! That's cruel!
But
it was actually the rock was even slower, the one with the version of skewer turrets. That'd be nasty.
Alright, I'll stop the wahoos basically having wet dreams over aircraft here. We'll go back to normal things.
You know, there has been talks about, could a swordfish take off from HMS Queen Elizabeth?
Ooh. Ooh. Oh. Well, you don't need the ramp, so technically you just ditch that. You'd be fine.
Well, I said it's long enough.
You just take off the starboard side of the bow.
Take off on the starboard side, or they could take off the stern.
To be honest, you can take take off the stern.
Yeah.
But you don't need the ramp. That's the problem.
Yeah.
The ramp's just ramp's a nice place just to put the jack staff and ensign staff. That's all it is. It's a bit of CB Randy Seagate. But, yeah, I'll go back to the original question. I think we'll go for the more of the supersonic missile. I think the naval strike missile is probably going to be the better one. Just looking at what China has on its 52 Alpha, I think. They've got
so many of them, you're allowed to get it wrong.
Yeah.
You are allowed to.
One of the destroyers. One of the destroyers has got multiple Cicade launchers on it. And I think we'll move away from that. Go for more of the what another one's got, which has got the supersonica versions. We'll probably go for that, but probably about 8 as usual. I don't know why the Royal Navy seems to just always want to go for 8. Or it's the same with the 23s, the batch 322s.
Into the war era destroyer flotillas. Basically, the Royal Navy just likes 8. We do not know why the Royal Navy just likes 8. You do not want to know the amount of arguing that went on in the Royal Navy to get them away from having the idea of 8 main guns for their battleships. 8 was the joyous number. And then sort of going, no, we're going to go to, well, eventually go to 10, begrudgingly. 9 was just, they just hated 9. They just hated it on Nelson and Rodney. And honestly, I think all the plans for them having ships which had 12, they possibly would be happy with, because it's 1.5, 8. But really, it's got to be either be 8 or 16. So if they could get the quadruple turret working and they could have had 16, 14-inch guns, then they would have probably been happy.
Like, Russia likes the 8s as well. Just including the Admiral Shapskanov with its switchblade refit and the possibility of it having another 2 quad launchers. They like the 8s, but then it comes to the Pezavaleki and the Admiral Nakamov. I think it's the other Kirov. With its pretty much a missile farm. I think they'll just stick with the 8. Maybe push to 16 at a push, but you need a lot more funding for that one. And to be honest, most of the funding is going for the flipping Space Force. Yes.
Because hey, look, it's nice to have a Space Force
somewhere.
And just think, at some point, you could be on HMS, whatever we call it, in space. Or would it be HMSS? HMSS?
to be honest, given this, the Royal Navy, let's face it, given that the Royal Navy is the kind of organization that when the Suez Canal was opening and the French had the ship first in line, they deliberately sneaked their own ship through in the night so that they could be first through. If we ever do get to a point of actually having a fully commissioned spaceborne warship, I would put good money on somebody deciding to name it HMS Enterprise purely to annoy the Americans.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. The Royal Navy and trolling. It's as if they make it into a whole service sport.
See, they used to, but now they're a bit more, what's the word?
PC?
They're very PG these days. Unfortunately, it's rather annoying.
I'm just thinking about the amount of times in my life I've seen various variations of the BARV, that's the Beach Recovery Vehicle in the British service, which has had large metal poles stuck on it, which makes it look like it has guns, just to wind up various NATO people at exercises.
Yes. Although, I think they might go back to more VLS. Things the idea.
So just have more cells.
Yeah, pretty much. Because you can probably get more bang for your buck from VLS than you can from sticking two quad launchers like that on your ship. Just because then the plus they'd be more versatile in the utility net. Like 26 have been fitted with the Mark 41 VLS system. They can take TLAMs, TASMs if they still got them around. I don't think they do, but you can get the idea of that one. And then the batch, the Flight 2 Bravos of the Arleigh Burks have ditched their harpoons. And I'm pretty sure they're going from VLS as well. So VLS is probably the way to go these days. Except for Russia does like to crack out the weird twin arm launchers for its SAMs to just pop out of the deck. Like a Transformer.
That does remind me of you probably won't have heard this. I know Dr. Clark has, some of our viewers haven't. Commander Steve George, when he was on Invincible in the Falklands, he has a wonderful story about trying to maintain. He was trying to work on one of the Sea Kings on the forward parking spot, forward of the superstructure, and as he's just happily working away on the Sea King, then all of a sudden he just hears. And up pop a pair of sea darts about 10 feet away. Point. Dive, hide.
Yeah, I have a funny story about that, actually. So when I did cadets as a kid, there was a lieutenant commander who was one of the officer watchers on board the Invincible when it did its sea dart launch trial off the coast of Scotland. And he was saying that apparently when they trained the launcher and the missile went off, apparently it set fire to the rigging store underneath the ski ramp, which is actually behind a door. So it's kind of just set fire to everything in there. But granted, the missile went off pretty well, but yeah, that's great when you've obviously fired the missile and all of a sudden fire fire in 01 Bravo 4. And then you're thinking, oh geez, here we go. Don, to be honest,
I don't know. They are fun systems, but no. I have a feeling I wouldn't mind seeing the Type 45s retrofitted, because they are fitted for, but not with the Mark 41 VLS. I have a feeling if they do get it, the debate will be whether they get anti-ship missiles or they get some form of TALAM. And the idea will probably be, can we get something which will do both roles?
It'd be nice if someone bought the... because we've already got Storm Shadow in the RAF. And the French have Scalp N, which is basically naval Storm Shadow, which they can stick in their VLS. It'd be nice to get that. Call it Sea Shadow.
But for that, we'd have to buy Silver A70, wouldn't we?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you can fit Scalp N in a Mark 41.
To be honest, the 45s are fitted with the Slavo launchers anyway. But there's an extra compartment, there's about a deck worth of like gap underneath the actual launchers to fit the Mark 41s. So they do have the utility for it, and also
they
can
have
retrofitted for the 5-inch.
They have the A50s, don't they?
I think so.
Yeah, because they have the 3/4 length rather than the 1/2 length or the 1/4 length.
Okay. I'm not good with the SAMs, to be fair.
Don't worry. I always point this out. Son of a naval architect. This is this disturbing stuff which is stuck in my brain after years of thinking about it. I'm a historian and a family of engineers. Okay? I understand the engineering. I don't want to do it, which is why I'm a historian. Which annoys them no end, but I it's what I do. But leaving that to one side, the problem is then it becomes the politics, because if you're buying, and it's going to sound strange, there is, at the moment with Brexit and all these things, British government is very committed to you know, showing it's going to be useful to Europe, but also it wants to be very much showing it's not under control of Europe. So I have a feeling it will probably be buying the American, because that's the other option. Your options are, let's say, the Salva or the Mark 41, or possibly the Mark 53, but I've got the wiring to take that. They've got the wiring for the Mark 41. I would prefer the Mark 53, because the Mark 53 is cool. It's the new one, but I don't think they would fit that in. And also, you know, the fact is the Mark 53 was pretty much designed along with the Zumwalt class. And despite it working really, really well, people are still considering the Zumwalt class a failure, because the centerpiece, what was made the centerpiece of its design, which probably shouldn't have been made the centerpiece of its design, which should have been said to be a future evolution we're going to put in, hasn't worked.
That comes back to my consistent insistence that people should follow the warrior doctrine when you are a large navy, rather than the French doctrine. I don't know if you've heard me espouse on the warrior doctrine before, James.
I'm guessing go for warrior instead of a junicole.
Yeah, it's basically warrior is. For and I know some of the listeners have heard me talk about this on previous episodes, but
it never hurts to say it again.
True. The Warrior Doctrine is reflecting on HMS Warrior. The Royal Navy, prior to the introduction of the Ironclad warship, they had experience building iron warships. They had experience working and testing armor. They had experience with armor-piercing guns as far as they went for the period. They had experience with steamships. They had experience with large ships. And they were constantly keeping all of these things under test and under review. That's why, although it's somewhat overblown, you had the Rattler versus Electo trials between paddle and screw and all sorts of things like this. So they were keeping abreast of technological developments. They were doing some of their own experiments, and they were keeping a very close eye on what everyone else was doing. And where specific developments had certain utility, they were introducing them already. That's why you had the steam screw battleships. But they were the wooden ones that had been converted. But what they didn't do was try and launch a brand new class that had some kind of hyper advancement that was supposed to be the one big advance and obsolete their own fleet and possibly not have it all work. They waited till someone else took that leap. So the French took that leap with Gloire. And obviously, because it was a bit of a leap for them, it was a little bit half baked. It was a wooden ship with iron plate literally screwed into it. And then the Royal Navy went, oh right, you finally pulled the trigger and built an ironclad warship, that's cute, watch this, and then put warrior together. So they're like, okay, well, you have this kind of weird hybrid wooden screw ship that you've kind of stuck some metal to. We have now built a fully iron, fully armored warship with a well thought out armor system, a full battery of armor piercing guns. We've invented the Citadel while we're at it, and it's faster than you and bigger than you, better protected, better armed, etc. So it was kind of, it combined all of these advances into one ship, which they then leveraged their economic and industrial power to build almost as quickly as the French built Gloire anyway. And to me, for our large navy, that seems to be the better way to go. You wait for someone else to do all the expensive mistakes, and then you go and just build an even bigger, better version. Whereas if you, the Zumwalts are kind of the very antithesis of that, where they've kind of gone, we're going to build a ship. What are you going to put on it? We don't know. We'll invent some weapons for it. And then they build the ship. And as we've said, they're kind of like, most of them don't actually work. This is embarrassing. To be honest, they kind of had the same problem with the LCS. If they'd been following a warrior style doctrine, it would have been, we're going to work on modularity, we're going to work on all these individual systems, and we're going to look at them as possible upgrades for our existing ships, possibly integrated into this modular system.
If they'd been following the warrior modularity, they'd have gone and bought Stanflex. It works.
Well, that would have been part of it. It would have been a case of like, that Stanflex, let's take from that and make a better version of our own, but we'll have it as a trial thing. And then brought it all together and said, right, we have a modular system that works, we have these weapon systems that works, we have this hull that maybe we've run a trial ship for that can actually will run at 40 knots or whatever without breaking.
Wasn't that what HMS Triton was for, though? Because that HMS Triton was the joint program with the Royal Navy to test out a Trimaran hull, and Interesting enough, it spent more time, I don't know, doing what? Triton doesn't seem to be in service or doing anything for very long anyway.
Border, it's a border patrol vessel for the Australians now, I think.
I thought it's back in the UK because they're no longer using it.
Could be. If it's back in the UK, I might try and find out where it's gone.
I read about it when I was at sea last, and I can't remember what it was. I think it's still in Australia, I think.
But yeah, it's the... It's this principle of, yeah, if they'd done it the right way round, they could have had a very, very nice warship. And instead, they've now got the LCS and the Zumwalt, both of which they've built before actually checking to see if the stuff they were going to install on it worked. And as a result, they've wasted a vast amount of money. Much as some people perhaps overly... I mean, going over to China, a lot of people say, oh, yeah, China's just copying everything that the West does, which... smacks me very, very dangerously of exactly what everyone was accusing the Japanese of doing in the 1930s, and look how well that worked out for everybody.
And what everyone was accusing the Germans of doing in the 1900s mm-hmm. for the British.
Yeah. Mm. But at the end of the day, the Chinese are, weirdly enough, actually following more of that, the actual better design doctrine, in that they are testing individual elements of their systems, and then putting them all together in a new destroyer type, albeit that they are playing a lot of catch up, so they are constantly iterating their way up.
Yeah. Be honest, the new ones are cruisers. Sorry, the Type 55s are cruisers. They are massive.
But it's like, even when you look at their submarines, the SSNs, they've got the Type 93s, and yeah, the Type 93s. Probably the only way they could be noisier would be if they just took all the kitchen silverware and strapped it to a bunch of chains and towed it behind them. But they haven't.
Or everyone in the sub just started steel drum band or something like that. You know, yeah, we're just doing this. We're just stealing. I don't know what we're on the hull. Use the hull as a giant steel drum.
But the thing is that they haven't fallen prey to the mistake of going, oh, okay, well, now we have to try and build like a Type 93 Mod 1 and a Mod 2 and a Mod 3 and a Mod 4, and everyone has a new iteration. They're kind of just running them because they're fairly certain they're not going to get in a shooting war in the next year or two. They're just running them and going, yeah, okay, they may not be anywhere close to a Seawolf or a Virginia or an Astute or a Trafalgar or even a late model 688i, but... we're learning. And then they're going to put all of that into the Type 95 whenever that starts going, and so there'll be a big jump in capability between the 93 and the 95.
They've also bought some Russian subs, haven't they?
They had a Kilo floating around at one point.
They do a lot of testing on their Mod Kilos. Their Mod Kilos get a lot of their design skills, and their Mod Kilos are getting fairly good. But I thought they managed to get a Russian nuke boat.
I think they got an Akula.
The Russians did love leasing Akulas out to everyone. I know they leased one to the Indians at one point.
Still got it.
Yeah.
They got three, I think. Last time I checked.
Are the Indians still paying for them, or have the Russians kind of forgotten that they left them out?
I don't know. India's a weird country of having lots of things from the West and also a lot of things in the East. It's an interesting country.
Yeah. It's a very sensible model if you think about it from their perspective, because their perspective is they don't want to be reliant on anyone and they want to try and build up their own industry. So whichever power offers them best deal for helping their own industry, they'll go with.
Mm. Now, if only they could sort out their own industry.
Well, that's a
risk. They managed to ruin the AK-47. I don't know how they did that.
The trouble was they started with a good rifle and they tried to improve it and to make it simpler and work it. Whereas what they should have done is start with bought the S-80. And then there is no way you could make that gun worse, the first version of it. Anything you do will make it better. The first generation of S-80 is frankly...
atrocious.
I think whoever decided to give it to people going to the front line should probably be taken somewhere and quietly given a cigarette and a
blindfold.
Yeah.
One of the things that forever does tick me off about the SA-80 is the ejection port only comes on one side, which means as a left-handed person, the only SA-80 I can ever handle is an airsoft one that doesn't eject cartridges into my face.
Yeah.
although I do sometimes wonder if the INSAS rifle was a collaboration between Russia and India to provide Russia with free power, because I have a feeling that if you connected a dynamo to Kalashnikov's grave, the existence of the INSAS would probably provide power to half of Russia for the next century.
I would also add, before we get fully away from the SAAC, I would like to add the point out that for most of the rifle drill, there is actually various sharp metal bits which are actually in the wrong space, place, that have to be switched sides on the gun, because otherwise they will crack into your shoulder and break you. Or alternatively, they will take off your nose going past.
You should not take the back end off, it just goes twice.
Yeah.
It's always good.
Don't get me started. Oh, the other thing, I don't know if anyone else here has ever spotted this sort of experience with the SAAT. The position that they tend to, for drill, to put the bayonet in, and for ceremonial drill, and then you draw it, it gets drawn around and put on. The amount of times that the bayonet, it's the only bayonet I've ever known, which can go springing off, can actually go vertically off the top of the gun.
Yeah.
Going, how? Sliding to one side, I can understand, but actually bouncing off?
Maybe it's a kind of hidden close quarters combat potential. It's like if you're 4 feet away from the enemy, but they've got a gun drawn on you, you're like, okay, I'm putting the gun out, I'm putting spring.
It's a ballistic knife. Just on a rifle.
Oh,
so one thing in COD you always try to get around to do,
but it's like a rifle grenade, but with the stabby thing.
Yes, and they're not nice when you see it go into someone accidentally.
I do love some of the drill that goes on in the British Armed Forces, though, because there is that one, of course, the bayonet goes back behind your back, and the amount of people I have seen over the years stab themselves putting it behind themselves, and they're just carrying on, and it's afterwards they're really, really happy the uniforms are the color they are, because it doesn't shed a blood.
Unless you're in tropics.
Yeah, if you're in tropics, then good luck.
Yes.
Okay. So,
don't do ceremonial in tropics when you have to hold a bayonet.
When she told me that last week, then I wouldn't have volunteered for guard next year.
Oh, no, the guard is fun.
Yes, it is. It's good fun.
Given we hit the hour, we've just gone over the hour.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess we'll wrap it up with one final, hopefully relatively short bit of discussion, which is when it comes this, and this is something that has intrigued me for a while.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the warheads themselves,
okay,
we've obviously had I can't remember what, I think it might have been Granit or one of the Russian missiles that kind of it has one that will fly above the rest as a spotter, and then if it that dies, another one will come up and the rest of them stay low. But that's more sensor package thing. But when it comes to the warheads themselves, I wonder if there's ever been any thought given to, and I know an EMP warhead is probably more diverging towards science fiction than science fact at the moment, but given that we were talking an episode or two back about putting up kind of a flak chaff flare wall with some 20 twin 40 millimeter CIWS variants to confuse incoming missiles, I wonder if anyone's thought of equipping a missile or two with effectively a massive chaff flare warhead, flying it ahead of everything, blowing it up. The missiles know, obviously, because they're part of the swarm, they know that they can fly through that, but the defensive ships that are trying to shoot at it, now they just see this big wall of noise, which obviously, especially with supersonic missiles, even a 5-10 second lag before you can engage again is going to let those missiles cover a lot of distance.
So there isn't anything that's like that from a warship, but a shooting warship to the other one.
Yeah.
But on the defending ship, you have chaff. And you have like multiple different types. I'm not going to get into that, but pretty much it's like firing superheated tinfoil off the ship. Those are literally in rocket motors anyway, so they'll fly off the ship. There was one that was designed, which is no longer in service. It's like a jammer.
Mm-hmm.
They try and use that would fly off and it's like a parachute fly down. But no, to answer the question, no, there isn't a missile that will fly in front of the attacking missiles and blow a wall of chaff. Because if you think about when you're launching a salvo of missiles, it's either going to be like that, like come in like that, or it'll be there or there or some other variation. It might be have a little bit of dispersion on it. And if you roughly puff off some chaff in front of this wall, you're still going to see a few on the other side of it.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of the reason why they wouldn't do it, especially if you're firing a missile that's going a mark stupid, fires off its chaff. It ain't going to do much. It's just going to into the sea.
Fair enough.
So that's kind of why you only have the chaff off ships.
Mm-hmm.
But there's like subduction, subdusion, and there's another one. Can't actually remember it right now. Subduction, subversion, and distraction. Same thing in it. Yeah. That's been around for flipping years.
Yeah.
And hopefully soon they actually carry on rolling out the Centurion and the Kemmering Centurions, which are those trainable launcher systems for countermeasures they have. They've been talking about these for about the last 10, 12 years. They keep saying they're going to be fitted to ships for the last 10, 12 years. I think they've even been talked about for the last 25 years. I'm fairly sure my dad was involved in them at some point. The man was a workaholic, but I can't think where I get my tendencies from at all. But no, that's sort of the trainable launchers, and they look fairly cool, but it's when they actually get deployed, and the launcher just keeps evolving and looking cooler, but it doesn't. There seems to be a lot of money going into develop it from coming from somewhere, but it's not being deployed anywhere yet.
No. So the CNAT, or whatever the hell you call it, the 3-inch launcher, is been around since the Falklands, roughly. And that's still a decent system anyway. I think the problem with that new launcher they were going to try and find was actually trying to reload that for, like, each... I don't know how to explain. For certain missile, you'll have a certain, deployment type thing. And trying to reload it within a certain time, I think, is the problem on the new launcher. Whereas with a CNAT, you just go for the mag, launch, run away for a little bit, fire, reload. And it's like a 30-second reload, maybe a 20-second reload, depending on what you're firing up. I think with those, you have to pop the side down, launch it in, pop it around, rotate some fires. So I think that's the reason why it's taken a while. It's the trying to automate it and actually make it faster. Mm-hmm. Unless they just have a magazine below and it just pops up a chaff round and fires it.
That would probably be sensible, because it's supposed to have, I think, 12 or so launch cells that it sort of goes around and rotates. And, you know, I can imagine that's... that's nice because it gives you 12 shots, whereas I think the CNATS gives you about 3.
It's 6 per launcher.
6 per launcher.
Yeah.
Why was I thinking 3? I have no idea. That's fine. Just me being wrong. But, no, so that's sort of... It's nice, but it is going to take, it'll be a lot longer to reload, and that's a problem.
Yeah, and the thing is, some of the, especially the chaff ones, the chaff canisters are actually a one-man lift, whereas when it comes to the, say, for instance, like an IR one, that's definitely a two-man lift, and you don't want to drop that, because that's phosphorus. That doesn't well.
So basically, to make it work, what you're saying we need is exoskeletons.
Yes, or... a magazine below.
Come on, which would be cooler? Which would you prefer to have? A magazine below, or you being allowed to dress up in an exoskeleton?
Preferably me not on the upper deck when there's a missile coming inbound.
But you'd be in an exoskeleton, so you might be able to grab the missile.
You're probably still flying off the other end with it.
Yes, but let's be honest, you look like Iron Man.
Here is your exoskeleton. Here is our latest anti-missile system. It is a titanium cricket bat. Something tells me I'm not walking away from that.
Oh.
Okay. Well, that
just think it would be a finding a good use for the English cricket team.
I'm not saying anything because I'm not English.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, we've hit an hour 15. Mm-hmm. So I think we should probably wrap up the formal part of the recording there.
That's fine. Yeah, so
thank you everyone for listening.
It's all right, we've covered anti-ship missiles, what type they are, and how to defend against them.
I will add quickly a quick specific thanks to the, and I've just looked, as I got the latest data through, well, at the moment pending, to the 33 people in Portugal who listened to us last week.
Okay.
There were about 30,000, but there were 33 people in Portugal, so we love you.
Ah, sí, señor.
Right. Okay.
Well,
close enough. It's probably just with a slight lisp in Portugal. trust me. Well, I'm half Bolivian. Iberian languages as a whole sound like barbarism to me because South American Spanish, ironically enough, is descended from the Spanish equivalent of Queen's English. The actual Spanish these days is basically the to my ears, having grown up with Bolivian Spanish, is the equivalent of hearing like the worst stereotype Cockney come up and try and introduce himself proper, like in it.
See. Well, I won't start talking Welsh then, so don't worry, it's fine.
Right, I'm going to stop the recording there.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.